China says it is firmly against U.S. unilateral sanctions against Iran as Tehran and Beijing begin implementing a major agreement. Yemen dismisses the U.N. Security Council's call for the release of an Emirati ship that it seized earlier this month, carrying weapons and military equipment. And in Iran, coronavirus-related rates remain relatively low, thanks to the country's mass vaccination campaign. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Miz. Thanks for joining us. China once again voices its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. Foreign Minister Wang Yi says the U.S. is using its sanctions and political manipulation to interfere in Iran's internal affairs. Wang voices support for the ongoing efforts in Vienna to restore the 2015 deal from which the U.S. withdrew and reimposed sanctions on Iran. He says the U.S. is primarily responsible for all the troubles around the tattered agreement. The top Chinese diplomat made the comments as he hosted his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, in the city of Buchi on Friday.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdollahian is visiting China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year Comprehensive Strategic Cooperation Agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then-Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, it's been revealed from the agreement. But the two
technological and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing visa aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018 after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urged Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
Today, we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense. And the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. The two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Fuji.
Yemen dismisses the UN Security Council's call for the release of an Emirati flagship that it seized earlier this week. Sana says the vessel was carrying weapons and military equipment, not dates or toys for children. Yemen's deputy foreign minister says that the cargo was destined for extremist groups who threaten the lives of Yemeni people. Hossein al-Azi says the ship belongs to a country involved in a devastating war on Yemen. The vessel has entered Yemen's territorial waters in breach of international law. The Yemeni official says that it is regretful that the UN body has turned to a platform for misleading public opinion and shamelessly demonstrating solidarity with murderous regimes. The Security Council issued a statement on Friday urging an immediate release of the Rabi, which was seized off Yemen's western port city of Hodeidah. In Iran, COVID-related figures remain relatively low thanks to the country's mass vaccination campaign. Only 18 deaths in the past day. That takes the total number of fatalities to around 132,000. Some 1,400 new infections were also diagnosed, bringing the total caseload to over 6 million. Iran witnessed record number of infections and deaths back in August. But the figures began declining since the authorities implemented a vaccination campaign nationwide. Over 125 million jabs have been administered, covering the majority of the population. India's Supreme Court has ordered a probe into recent incidents of hate speech against the country's Muslims. The investigation follows public outrage and people questioning Prime Minister Modi's silence and inaction. We've discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's listen to what our guests had to say.
Welcome to this edition of the News Review. In this edition, India's Supreme Court has ordered a probe into recent incidents of hate speech against the country's Muslims. The investigation follows huge public outrage, with people questioning Prime Minister Narendra Modi's silence and inaction. Munawar Zaman has more from New Delhi.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue.
Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence.
Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively. Since last few years, Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS, and so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Now to discuss that further, we're joined by Mr. Masood Shajare, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London, and also Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who is joining us also from London. Thanks to both of you, gentlemen, for joining us on this edition of the News Review. Let's begin with Mr. Shajare. In your opinion, why is it that Narendra Modi is not showing really the kind of reaction that one would expect towards these hate crimes?
Well, actually, I think he is showing the reaction that one expects, because if you look at his history, when he was in charge of Gujarat, that was the one of the first times that some genocidal act and mob attacked Muslims. And he was never brought to account on this. And, you know, there were reports, including from ourselves, highlighting how many people were deliberately targeted by the Hindu mobs. Now, the ideology of Hindutva, which is sort of goes forward saying that India is for Hindus and Muslims and Christians have got no right to it, And as a matter of fact, they, you know, teaching it to the kids and you know, the whole community, saying that these people have come and taken over Hindu heritage. And so that's sort of to demonize and disown the right of Muslims and others, including Christians, in where we are now. And the fact that so little is being done so regards incident, it's actually a testimony which direction India is going. This present government is part and parcel of Hindutva ideology, which denies the right of anyone else, and indeed promotes a very, very extreme Hindu ideology, which is basis, I believe, for future genocide. And if something is not done now immediately, we are sleepwalking into genocide.
Okay, Mr. Shajar, since you mentioned that something needs to be done, I would like to address this question to Syed Mohsen Abbas. Now, India's Supreme Court has ordered a probe in these recent incidents. Do you think this is going anywhere?
Well, on evidence of the way legislators and the legal system has been operating since the BJP certainly has come into power, I don't really expect a great deal to happen. We've seen the legislature fail in terms of any kind of justice on the incident which really brought this whole Hindutva movement into the front line politically, and that was the destruction of the Babri Mosque. That kind of formally in 2019 was legally sanctioned, even though it had been taken over long ago, by the judiciary. So I think that there's an institutional Islamophobia which is very much embedded now within the system, and the government itself rewards such institutional Islamophobia. It seems, for instance, I mean, Amit Shah himself, the right hand man of Modi, has said that Muslim migrants are termites and that they should be thrown in the Bay of Bengal. Now, when you've got leaders at the top saying this publicly, it's no surprise that these other fellows are distributing hate crime publicly off platforms.
Thank you very much, Syed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, and Mr. Masood Shajareh, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, both from London. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your comments, and thanks for following this edition.
Coming up next, Hashtag Trending will bring you social media's hottest conversations and debates surrounding the issue of Palestine.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another Hashtag Trending. And today, we'll also be talking about the issue of Palestine. I mean, well, technically about the Israeli Judaization policy of Palestinian lands and its latest manifestation in the desert of Al-Naqab. Stay with me. This time around, we're taking you to the desert of Al-Naqab, where the Bedouin Palestinians have been dwelling in for decades now. But now, the occupation forces are after their ancestral lands under the pretext of an afforestation project.
The protests started peacefully. Nobody was harmed. We were chanting. We were talking. It is our right to protest for what we believe in today as Palestinian Bedouins living in occupied Palestine. It is our right, yet they do not give us our rights. They treat us like refugees in our own land. This is not their land. This is ours. We have been here before 1948, before Israel became Israel. We are not refugees. This is a family. There is a graveyard here with someone who is 400 years old. A whole generation of death in the graveyard is here. Women getting arrested.
The desert of Al-Naqab has historically been inhabited by Arab tribes or Bedouins, but most of them are not recognized by Israel and thus are deprived of most basic services such as water or electricity, and now this. Let's get the comments wheel spinning with this first one by Al-Mayadeen English. The Israeli occupation has been conducting mass arrests against Palestinians in resource-rich Naqab, which Israel looks to turn into a military base. On to the next one by Quds News Network. This Palestinian young man was protesting against the Israeli ethnic cleansing of Al-Naqab lands in the southern occupied Palestine before he was brutally arrested not by the Israeli occupation forces, but by the colonial state-backed settlers. On to our next comment by Birnz500. How many cowards of the Apartheid Defense Force does it take to arrest a 12-year-old girl in the process of conducting ethnic cleansing and land theft in the Naqab? A whole battalion, I suppose, but perhaps the better question is, how many Palestinians should die before it's too many? Or how many Palestinians should die before the world takes notice? The whole thing is just insane. Moving on to our next batch of comments, Anghadhu al-Naqab, that is my attempt at pronouncing Arabic letters correctly, wrote, a house was set on fire by the bombs fired by the occupation, hashtag save al-Naqab. Moving on to our next comment by Sarah Wilkinson, she said, this license to abuse Palestinian children who are simply defending their homes in al-Naqab looks like an Israeli blood sport, hashtag save al-Naqab. Another instance of utter insanity. I mean, what do these people want? But fortunately, not everyone is blind to the truth on the ground, just like Harry Potter star Emma Watson had that Instagram post of showing solidarity with the Palestinians, and also like these tweets. V Palestine tweeted, Palestinian students protesting in Tel Aviv University in solidarity with Palestinians in Al-Naqab. Let's move on to our final photo and comment of the day coming from Brighton BDS. BDS stands for Boycott, Divest, Sanctions, an anti-Israeli apartheid movement. They wrote, total solidarity with all those resisting the Israeli state's attempts to force them from their land. That'll do it for this edition of Hashtag Trending. Stay tuned for the rest of the world news.
France in yet another weekend of anti-vaccination protests in the country amid a fresh surge in COVID infections. Thousands of people now on the streets of Paris are holding banners and chanting slogans, slamming policies of President Emmanuel Macron. They are infuriated over a new government plan to further restrict the unvaccinated. Once approved by the Senate, the bill requires everyone above 12 to show their vaccine passes while entering a restaurant, using public transport, or attending an event. A negative test will no longer be enough. This is while COVID-related figures remain high in France, with more than 300,000 cases reported almost on a daily basis. The Omicron variant is taking most of the blame. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.
Ocean warming keeps breaking records, which is a reminder that the world needs action to combat climate change, says Kenny Stansel, journalist, in an article published under the heading Oceans Hotter in 2021 than any time in recorded history. Stay tuned for more. New research shows that the world's oceans last year were hotter than they've ever been in recorded history, part of a long-term warming trend driven primarily by planet-wrecking fossil fuel emissions. This finding really underscores the urgency of acting on climate now. According to an annual study published in the peer-reviewed journal Advances in Atmospheric Sciences, the past 5 years have been the five hottest for Earth's oceans since measurements began in the late 1950s. Since the late 1980s, oceans have been warming 8 times faster than they did during the preceding decades, and 2021 marked the third consecutive year in which the previous record for annual energy absorption was shattered. These trends, the paper makes clear, are due to an increase in anthropogenic greenhouse gas concentrations. We want to stress that global warming is actually ocean warming, and ocean warming has serious consequences. Li-Jing Cheng, a lead author of the report and professor of environmental science at the Institute of Atmospheric Physics at the Chinese Academy of Sciences, told CNN, "Ocean warming keeps breaking records, which is a reminder that the world needs action to combat climate change." The research on rising ocean heat content comes one day after the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service published an assessment showing that the past 7 years have been the hottest in recorded history. Like rising global surface air temperatures, the ongoing ocean warming pattern is caused by carbon dioxide and methane emissions, researchers say. Greenhouse gas pollution has surged over the past 2 centuries, due largely to fossil fuel-powered capitalism and its insatiable profit motive. As excess heat is trapped in the planet's atmosphere, oceans absorb 90% of it, leading to a sharp increase in ocean heat content, the paper explains. The impacts are perhaps subtle but profound. Kevin Trenberth, a co-author of the New Ocean Report and scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado, told CNN, adding, "To stop this trend, we really need to get to net zero emissions, and many countries have plans, but not enough actions to support those." Before and during the recent COP26 climate summit, many governments pledged to reduce planet heating pollution in the coming years, but new data showing a steady increase in greenhouse gas emissions and atmospheric concentrations reveals that empty promises won't be enough to avert the climate emergency's most catastrophic consequences. If policymakers fail to take swift and robust action to decarbonize the world's energy system and economy, scientists warn ocean heat content will continue to climb, further exacerbating extreme weather disasters that are already increasing in frequency, duration, and intensity. Warmer oceans supercharge weather patterns to create more powerful storms, hurricanes, and intense rainfall, which leads to deadly flooding, CNN noted, pointing to Hurricane Ida's devastating effects, along the ensuing inundation of New York City's subway system, and Super Typhoon Rai, which killed hundreds of people in the Philippines over the holidays.
The increase in ocean heat also raises air temperatures, allowing more moisture to enter the warmer atmosphere, according to the Washington Post. For every 1.8 degrees of warming, heavy rain events will intensify by about 7%. 2021 marked one of the wettest years on record for the East Coast, thanks to a slew of tropical storms and summer thunderstorms. The unusual December tornadoes that struck several states can also be traced back to the warm waters. In December, record warm temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico created an atmosphere more reminiscent of spring than winter. As such, two tornado outbreaks occurred in the southern and central United States in the same week. Moreover, higher ocean temperatures threaten to disrupt marine life, which supplies a quarter of the world's protein and put millions of people at risk of accelerated sea level rise. Ocean warming is destabilizing Antarctic ice shelves from underneath, which could lead to the collapse of large pieces of ice sheet, such as the Thwaites Glacier, threatening massive sea level rise. Michael Mann, a climate scientist at Pennsylvania State University and one of the authors of the study, told the Post, adding, "This finding really underscores the urgency of acting on climate now." According to reports, as the oceans heat up, the water expands and sea level rises. Chang said about one-third of the total sea level rise during the 20th century was due to ocean warming alone. In addition to more high tide flooding, sea level rise threatens coastal freshwater supply with saltwater intrusion and makes coastal communities and infrastructure more vulnerable to storm surge. Change said part of the reason action is so urgently needed is because the oceans will continue warming for decades after fossil fuel emissions are slashed. As Trenberth explained, the oceans are slow to respond, which is why we must prepare better and build resilience now. The dangers associated with ocean warming, states the paper, should be incorporated into climate risk assessments, adaptation and mitigation, and be reflected in engineering design, building codes, and modifications to coastal development plans.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
In early January, South Africa bade farewell to Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the last great hero of the struggle against apartheid. Tutu opposed the evils of racism, oppression, intolerance, and injustice, not just during the apartheid era in South Africa, but wherever in the world he saw moral wrongs. This is how South African President described the late Archbishop Tutu during his funeral ceremony.
A humble and brave human being who spoke for the oppressed, the downtrodden, and the suffering of the world.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who passed away last December. He was the last in a generation of great heroes who struggled against the apartheid regime in South Africa. Internationally, he was a renowned supporter of the Palestinian struggle against the Israeli apartheid regime. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about the postponement of Libyan presidential election that was supposed to take place last December. We're asking, what are the local and international factors behind this postponement? So stay tuned as our experts give us their insight.
Tribute to Archbishop Tutu. On the first day of the year 2022, South Africa held a state funeral for Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the last great hero of the struggle against apartheid. Tutu died on the 26th of December, aged 90, triggering grief at home and across the world for a life spent fighting injustice. In 1984, Tutu won the Nobel Peace Prize for his struggle to end white minority rule on South Africa. That year, he traveled to the United States, where he condemned the Reagan administration's support for the apartheid regime in South Africa.
Apartheid is as evil, as immoral, as unchristian in my view, as Nazism. And in my view, the Reagan administration's support and collaboration with it is equally immoral, evil, and totally unchristian without remainder.
The late Archbishop Tutu will be remembered as a defender of Palestinian rights and a harsh critic of Israeli occupation and apartheid. He also backed international campaigns to boycott the brutal Israeli regime. Here is one of his statements in support of Palestine.
Critical mass of people want to see an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the oppression of its people.
Now, for more insight into the life and times of Archbishop Tutu, we contacted Professor Farid Isaac, a Muslim scholar, writer, anti-apartheid activist, and a close friend of the late Archbishop Tutu. He's also a member of Africa for Palestine movement. Welcome to our program, sir. Now, what would you say is the main legacy of Archbishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa and the world in general?
Desmond Tutu's main legacy was his relentless struggle for justice. Desmond Tutu was harsh in his criticism of the oppressor and oppression. And it was his willingness to take a leadership role at great cost and to speak the truth the apartheid regime, but later on in his iconic role as a supporter and defender of the oppressed throughout the world, particularly the Palestinian people. So that's his major legacy. The second part of his legacy, and I deliberately insist that it must be the second part, is his commitment to reconciliation.
Well, Professor Isaac mentioned there that Archbishop Tutu fully backed the struggle of the Palestinians against the Israeli regime.
In 2014, he joined thousands of people in Cape Town to protest against the Israeli regime's bombardment of Gaza. During the event, Tutu said the pursuit of the people of Palestine for freedom is a righteous cause.
The pursuit of the people of Palestine for freedom from humiliation, from persecution, from the unjust policies of Israel, that is something that is unstoppable because it is a righteous cause. It is a righteous cause. It is God's own cause. For God created us for freedom.
Professor Isaacs, can you briefly elaborate on Archbishop Desmond Tutu's support for the Palestinian liberation and opposition to the Israeli regime?
Now, Desmond Tutu had been, as a religious leader, he had been to Palestine on a number of occasions. And from the first occasion that he went, he said that what he has experienced, and this is why he was there even, what he experienced in Palestine was not just akin or something like apartheid in like South African apartheid, but that it was in fact in many ways much worse than what apartheid South Africa was. And he did not hesitate to call Israel an apartheid state, although of a worse kind than what South Africa was. Desmond Tutu had found Israel or Israeli society and the occupation of the Palestinian people far worse than what we as black South Africans had experienced under Israeli apartheid.
Now, Archbishop Tutu used his moral authority to speak out against atrocities perpetrated by the Israeli regime against Palestinians. Despite facing a backlash for his pro-Palestinian stance, he refused to back down and continued to support calls for the freedom of Palestine.
I am proud to support freedom for Palestine by one world. I urge everyone to buy the single and spread its message. Let's send a message to governments that a critical mass of people want to see an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the oppression of its people. By acting together, we can break cycles of injustice and the occupation and build a new world based on our common humanity and justice. Support freedom for Palestine. Peace. Shalom. Salam.
Now, Professor, how can Desmond Tutu's legacy be kept alive regarding his support for the oppressed Palestinian nation?
I think that an escalation of the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement is one of the important ways in keeping his legacy alive. He was very explicit in his support for the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. He described it as a non-violent movement, which indeed it is. However, Desmond Tutu, in the South African context, always indicated that it was the right of the oppressed people to decide on their means for liberation. And so a boycott of the Israeli state, a boycott of traveling to Israel, a boycott of buying and selling Israeli goods, the cutting off of diplomatic relations with Israel. And so the advancement of the boycott and sanctions movement, that will be a crucial way of retaining his legacy.
Tutu had put principle above political expediency in his outrage over the lack of prosecutions for those implicated in apartheid-era crimes. He warned that without reparations, through full confession or through prosecution, South Africans or any color or creed would not be able to heal from their traumatic past. Archbishop Tutu regretted that those who committed apartheid atrocities were not prosecuted and reparations were not paid to victims.
The one fascinating thing that he often addressed, why in the South African case, when it comes to black people, are black people expected to forgive? When it comes to other people, and he referred very specifically to this, despite the fact that he was accused of being anti-Semitic, when it comes to the Jewish people, the world is quite happy for 92, 93-year-old people who were soldiers in the Nazi army, for them to continue to be searched for and to be prosecuted and to be sent to jail. So what's going on here? Is it that white people must be forgiven when they are criminals? And when black people were hurt, then you expect these black people to forgive?
The late Archbishop Tutu was also an environmental activist. He joined Call for Action on climate change and warnings about the future of humanity on planet Earth if no action is taken.
The whole world stands faced with a common threat of climate change. This global threat already affects us all, in particular the poorest and the most vulnerable. That alone should move all governments to act. But my heart is heavy when I imagine the devastation that will face our children and our children's children if we do not act now to stop it.
Now, regarding climate injustice, Archbishop Tutu also called for an apartheid-style boycott of corporations financing these injustices. Now, can you elaborate on this, Professor?
Archbishop Desmond Tutu was very comprehensive in his understanding of justice. In looking at climate change, the kind of demands that are being made on the global south, or the countries that are generally called underdeveloped, I would prefer the term global south, demands are made upon them when they are in fact the least contributors to carbon emission and therefore to the problem of global warming and climate change. And yet they are being asked to lower their emissions when countries in the global north deliver up to 50% more per individual than what countries in the global south does.
Well, there you have it. The late Archbishop Tutu was very comprehensive in his understanding of justice. May his soul rest in peace. Thanks a lot, Professor Isaac, for your insight. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about the political crisis in Libya. So stay with us.
Libya elections crisis.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The Libyan presidential election was recently postponed, plunging the country into another political crisis. Now, the Libyan High National Election Commission announced that despite being technically prepared, it was unable to meet the 24 December date set by the political roadmap for national elections.
Citing inadequacies in electoral legislation and challenges and appeals related to the candidates' eligibility, the Commission requested that the Parliament set another date for the first round of the presidential election. However, Libya's Parliament refused to fix a date for presidential elections, leaving question marks about the fate of the poll. The Parliamentary Committee, charged with overseeing the election, presented a report saying it would be risky to set a new date at this stage.
A member of Libya's High Council of State said the postponement was not surprising at all.
We were expecting that the elections weren't going to happen on December 24th, but now setting a new date will also be a contentious issue. From a legal standpoint, the Parliament must agree with the High Council of State on a new date. The question now is, how long will the postponement be for?
Now, for more on the unfolding situation in Libya, we have contacted Mustafa Fituri, an independent Libyan academic and journalist. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us. Now, our first question to you, what are the real reasons behind the postponement of the presidential election in Libya?
The announced reason, or the official reason, if you like, is that there are some problems with the laws governing the presidential election, specifically law number 80, which was passed by the parliament last September. But the actual fact, the reasons behind this, two main reasons. One, there's a foreign interest in the elections by certain countries, and they do not really want the elections to go ahead at this time. That's one thing. The second thing, which is also related to the first reason, is that there are Libyan factions, especially members of the High Council of State and their backers, foreign backers, who do not want the elections to take place.
Everyone was waiting for these elections to save Libya. We want a president elected by the people to govern Libya, who would be recognized by all states in the world in order to get us out of this crisis. We don't know what's happening now. Until when will the elections be postponed? After December 24, but until when? 1 week, two, a year? Nobody knows. On the whole, nothing is clear.
More than 2.8 million of Libya's 7 million residents had registered to vote in the postponed general elections. Many Libyans were disappointed by the postponement because they had registered to vote under the current circumstances. A voter in Libya speaks here in support of the elections before the postponement.
I'm in favor of these elections. At least the situation will get better. We want our country to move forward.
How did most Libyans react to the postponement of the elections?
Well, the reaction was very bad, very negative public reaction, a sense of discontent, a sense of anger and disappointment, and people are, you know, fed up. And when you look at the numbers, you know, the number of people who received their voting cards is something like 2.5 million people. And the people who registered to vote is something like 2.8 million people, a little bit more than that, actually, which reflects a huge interest, public interest, in the elections in Libya.
Foreign powers have backed various factions in Libya's complex conflict, and the presence of mercenaries and foreign troops is one of the toughest obstacles to a lasting peace. In 2021, the UN estimated that 20,000 foreign fighters were present in Libya. The United Nations Secretary General previously warned that foreign interference in the conflict in Libya has reached unprecedented levels.
Time is not on our side in Libya. The conflict has entered a new phase, with foreign interference reaching unprecedented levels, including in the delivery of sophisticated equipment and the number of mercenaries involved in the fighting.
Now, you earlier mentioned about foreign interference in Libya's presidential election. Now, can you tell us which foreign actors are interfering in this country and what interests are they pursuing?
I name a few. The United States, for one, and the United Kingdom, for two, and Turkey, for three. Well, Turkey is not very, you know, kind of astonishing anti-election position, but still prefers to have someone else other than those two guys, you know, which are poised, as I said, to win at least the first round of elections. And the second round, Mr. Gaddafi Jr. is expected to lead and probably win by something like 60 to 65% margin of the vote. And because of that, it's the foreign powers again that destroyed Libya in 2011, they are more or less the same who are involved in the election and pursue it to make sure that Libya comes out of this upcoming election, whenever it takes place, even in the future, and the way they wanted it to be. They want to reshape Libya differently from what it had been over the last 40 years of Gaddafi time. They just want to end the chaos, but in their own way.
Now, even before Libyan High National Elections Commission postponed the election in December, some Libyans had earlier called for the polls to be called off, saying the country lacks a comprehensive legal framework to hold elections. Now, our law professor explains here on why he opposed the elections at this juncture.
Without a constitutional foundation in any nation in the world, you cannot conduct a proper and neutral and just election. This is ABCD. It is the very beginning lesson in democracy.
What's the way out of the current political crisis in Libya?
I am not with the idea of rush two elections. We are rushing two elections again, as we did in 2012 and 2014. It should have been at least another year before we have decided on this. But the problem with leaving the situation as it is now, the status quo as it is now, with those guys in power, especially the parliament and the higher council of state in Tripoli, nothing will ever happen, even in 10 years' time. They just want to keep the status quo as it is because it benefits them.
The instability in Libya has made the country a favorite transit point for illegal immigrants who use the central Mediterranean route to enter Europe. According to the International Organization of Migration, there were more than 610,100 migrants in Libya in September 2021. 9 in 10 migrants left their country of origin primarily for economic reasons. The majority of the migrants were from neighboring countries, especially Niger, Egypt, Sudan, and Chad. With Libya facing a real risk of political instability, Europe must prepare for a new wave of migrants from the country and beyond.
Now, how is the political stalemate in Libya impacting on the country being used as a route by illegal migrants going to Europe?
The current crisis is actually having a certain impact on that. Why? You know, the security situation in the country, especially the Coast Guard and the policing and all this, has already been failing to contain the flow of people out of Libya towards Europe over the Mediterranean Sea, where most of them die, unfortunately. They are already failing. And when you have such a political crisis in the country, that means the institutions, which are already weak, and they are incapable of performing, they become weaker and even more failing to do their duty, which means they open the door for more increased number of migrants attempting to go to Europe, and that's what we have been seeing over the last 3-4 weeks.
Well, thank you very much, Mustafa Fetouri. We shall definitely keep an eye on Libya as the situation unfolds there. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.